powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy
on Seattle Sports Station.
Powered by Kitsap Credit Union. Streaming through the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
This hour of Jake and Stacy brought to you by Advanced Hair Restoration, keeping the Seahawks talk going. Seattle kicking off OTAs today. Dave Wyman joining us now on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. Hey, Dave, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
We are well. We were just talking about who we think might become the Seahawks' third wide receiver. They've got in, they returned Will Disley. They brought in Noah Fant as part of that trade. We're going to see what D. Eskridge brings. Curious to think who you think might emerge in that role for Seattle.
Yeah, well, this has been my guess for the last, 3 years, and it's Will Disley, you know, because I love everything that Will Disley does. He's a great blocker. He runs good routes, and he catches the ball. So, yeah, and they just didn't throw it to him. And then he's had injuries. But, yeah, I mean, I heard you guys talking about D. Eskridge, and, you know, you got Tyler Lockett. Who knows, you know, what's going to happen with Noah Fant mm-hmm. to see, you know, what kind of a player he is. I think he's a it's kind of funny. We talked to Mark Schlereth, who lives in Denver, and he's not covering every single Denver game, but he was saying, well, he's more of an athlete than anything, but I think he kind of undersold him a little bit. I think Noah Fant's a pretty good target as well. So
yeah.
I think, you know, Will Disley, he could be actually the number two receiver if you're counting, you know, catches as opposed to yardage. But yeah, you hope that D. Eskridge takes that next step.
You do, and it doesn't need to be a big, massive, you know, to me, a statistical role for it to be a success for him going into the second year. I know that's a weird thing to say, but if he can find an active role within this offense, I think that will be a big win, and one of those is on special teams. I mean, that was one of the big reasons why they felt so good about drafting him. Where do you see that playing into it? Is there anybody out there that is going to compete with D. Eskridge for that role, or do you think he'll be able to take that and run with it? We haven't had a dynamic special teams guy since Tyler Lockett.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure who that guy is going to be, and it's a good question because, you know, the receiver group, all of a sudden, you know, there's just not that much focus on it because you don't have Russell Wilson anymore. So you're like, it's kind of funny. We were talking about this, like, when they had the tackles, and all of a sudden we stopped talking about it once Russ was gone. And I'm like, okay, are we just not going to protect the guy that is going to throw the ball this year, the quarterback? And kind of, you know, the focus has kind of gone away from protecting Russ and then finding him targets. And it's kind of gone to other areas. But yeah, I mean, as far as the Seahawks receivers, there's been a bunch of guys that, who's the guy I'm blanking on that, you know, every year they talked about him, the kid from Hawaii.
Oh, John Ursua.
Ursua, yeah. And he just never quite, you know, developed. So, yeah, that's going to be an interesting, even though it's not going to be focused on, I think that's going to be an interesting race to see, who's going to be the second, third, fourth wide receiver.
Now, Dave, I want to switch this over to defense here because this is going to be a critical time for the defense and for the entire team, obviously. But, you know, when you're transitioning to a newer scheme and making some adjustments, and you've got a bunch of newness to this defense, and this group has struggled to get started quickly over the past two seasons, what makes you optimistic that they could turn that trend around to start this season? Because that's going to be really important for this team.
Well, this will speak more to my frustration with the defense for the last two or three years. I just think it's instantly better.
Mm.
It's instantly going to be better because there were just so many things. We talked about, they've been talking a lot about being sticky with their coverage and matchup zone and stuff like that. And really all that means is just they're going to be more aggressive. They're going to be a more aggressive defense. And, you know, I don't care who you put out there. If you have the best players, if you're playing off and you're not, and you have guys, you know, violating just the most basic rules of zone coverage, jumping underneath stuff, those kinds of things, not being sticky with the guys crossing the middle. I mean, just because you drop back in a zone, that doesn't mean you just stand there and cover an area. You have to look receivers up and what I call crowd them, which means just within your zone, get close to the receiver that's the biggest threat. Like, you get your body in a position to where you can make a play on the ball. So, you know, I think that is already going to be so much better that I don't really care who you even put out there. But they do have some good defensive backs. We'll see what happens with corner. I'm a huge believer in Trey Brown. So, yeah, I just think it's instantly going to get better. But, you know, look, that's not setting a very high bar, right? Because they were 31st in passing yards allowed for 2 years in a row. So, and, you know, it just got worse and worse every year. So I'm really looking forward. And I don't care if they get beat over the top every once in a while. I'll take that. It's just the constant, you know, death by a thousand cuts, you know, down the field, in the middle of the field, you know, and not protecting those areas and not being more aggressive. And I think that's what's going to be, you know, and I've said this all along with all the new guys in the draft and free agents and everything. The biggest impact is going to be the defensive coaching staff. The change that they made to get Clint Hurt as the D coordinator and bring in Carl Scott and Sean Desai. I mean, I think those three guys right there are going to be all the difference.
Looking at the linebacker specifically, I want to narrow down that question even more. Jake and I, a while ago, were doing like a, hey, what's the position you're most excited for and the one you're most worried about? I said I was most eager to see the running backs, worried about corner still, just until we're kind of, you know, you get some proven guys there. I was pleasantly surprised how many people were really excited about linebacker. It was a position I didn't really think of, but I think when I did, I expected people to say they were worried about it, given the loss of Bobby Wagner. But do you look at it with some optimism, that position group?
Yeah, I do. I really do. I'm looking at Nick Ballore. That guy can play linebacker, I'm telling you. And I'm not sure if he's going to end up making the team or not. But, I mean, just the way they played inside, it was just really passive. Really passive. So, you know, if you just have Cody Barton, even Ben Burkervin. And the thing I always say about Ben Burkervin, if you are able to get to the right spot, I mean, I don't care how fast you are, how big you are, if you're going to the right spot every time, you got a chance to win. And that's Ben Burkervin. So they're going to get him back, you know, and then of course, you know, the best linebacker they have is Jordan Brooks. I mean, he is really a good player. So yeah, I don't think there's going to be a drop off. And then we'll see what happens with the 3-4 thing with Nwosu on the outside, you know, Boye Mafi, the way that they use those guys in that sort of 3-4 look where they're dropping every once in a while, because you typically want to rush four. And, you know, if one of the defensive ends is dropping and the other one is rushing the quarterback, it's going to look pretty much, I think, the same. A lot of people aren't going to be able to tell the difference, but it's just going to be a little bit of a change in philosophy.
Offensively, obviously, it's going to be a quarterback battle between Geno Smith, Andrew Luck. Do you have a preference with which quarterback you think could take the team a little bit further?
Well, I don't really know, just because, you know, here's what they're trying to do. They're trying to catch what they got out of Drew Lock his rookie year at the end of the year. That's the guy they think he can be. So, and if you go and look, he was, I think, 4-1 or 5-1 in that period of time. Threw a couple picks, but I think, you know, he had 6 or 8 touchdowns. He was, you know, around 62% completion percentage. If you give him a running game, you know, make it easy for him, make him more of like a game manager. I feel like that's going to be the guy. I'm just not sure about Geno, you know, and I really was a big champion of his last year, but, you know, and some of the things that I've kind of found out over the last few months and some of the things that have happened, and, you know, I'm just not sure if he's that guy, you know, but we'll see. I mean, they obviously have lots of confidence in him, but to me, I think it's Drew Lock, and I think it'll be kind of a disappointment if Drew Lock doesn't come out being, you know, having some hope when they start the season that this could be the guy. I think that'll be a disappointment to them.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that, Dave, and I think that sentiment is very strong. And hopefully, you know, I root for Drew Lock, who goes through an experience like that in Denver, and for a lot of guys, that's kind of it. That's kind of the mark on their career and everything else. But Drew's got a chance to show that he can learn and grow from his mistakes of the past and change and grow and develop and take this new opportunity and run with it. So definitely rooting for him. Dave, you talked about the offensive line and, you know, how that kind of has gone to the wayside a little bit. That is a group to me that I am really anxious to learn more about, because There's so much newness. I mean, you've got two potential rookie, you know, bookend tackles that obviously you feel very good about them and what their potential upside is, but they're still going to be rookies. And what is your confidence level in this offensive line? If you just look at it today, in this group being good enough to be relied upon to provide a, you know, a top tier running game.
Well, I think they're pretty good inside. I'm not sure how you guys think about that, but I felt like with the two guards and the center, they're in pretty good shape. I mean, as good as probably anybody in the NFC West. But the tackles, yeah, I'm with you on that, Jake. I've always been actually, you know, I was talking about the other day we did a thing with Bumpus, and it was who makes the playoffs first, the Mariners or the Seahawks? And I said the Seahawks, and Bumpus, you know, and Bob both said the Mariners, and he actually put my own quote back in my face. He's like, you always tell me you can't get much done with rookies out there. You can't rely on rookies. And I'm like, don't use my words against me. But yeah, it is. I am an old school that guy that way in that. You know, and I'll start a rookie. I'll put him out there, and I think that's one of the other things that needs to change a little bit with this team. They haven't trusted their rookies as much. They need to trust them. They need to just throw them out there. And you know, I go back to like Marquise Blair's rookie year. You know, yeah, he made a few mistakes, but yeah, just keep putting him out there, man. You know, kind of like in a little bit more like in baseball. It's like keep running him out there. We don't want to crush his spirit or anything like that, but he's going to make mistakes, but let's just kind of let him play through that. So I think there's going to be some growing pains that way because, yeah, I'm one that thinks that anything you get out of a rookie is icing on the cake, except if you're a top 10 pick. So, you know, I felt pretty good about Charles Cross. And but you know, as far as Abraham goes, that's going to be I think maybe they start off with Jake Curran, and then he takes over as the year goes on. But Jake Curran had a pretty good year last year, and you know, we'll see who else they have in camp. But I feel like that one might be a little bit tougher because he's a third rounder.
All right, he is Dave Wyman. You can hear him and Bob later today during Wyman and Bob starting at 2 p.m. Thanks so much, Dave.
Okay, guys, thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah. All right, let's get to Four Down Territory.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass. Going inside the game with quarterback guru Jake Heaps.
Jake Heaps played in the NFL, played quarterback, was in the room with him, was in the fire. He's really a guru. He really played.
First down, OTAs start today for the Seahawks. So, Jake, which Seahawk, one, singular, pick one, has the most to gain?
It's Drew Lock. Drew Lock has the most to gain over these OTAs, and he is the guy that I don't know if he's going to win. I don't think he's going to win the job in these OTAs, okay? But what I do believe is the conversation right now that Geno right now is the penciled-in starter at the moment. I think that it's like with a very faint pencil, okay, at the moment. But if you want to be able to change that narrative and to say that Drew Lock has really been able to emerge and really been able to put himself in position to win that competition, this is your opportunity. This is your opportunity to gain trust of your teammates, to gain trust of your offensive coordinator, to gain trust of your head coach and Pete Carroll, that you have learned from the mistakes of the past, that you're showing up every day, you master your playbook, you understand what's going on, you learn from your mistakes and come back the next day and is not a guy that repeats your mistakes, and that you can be trustworthy with the football in your hands. That is what Drew Lock's got to do. And if he can show that, if he can prove that to this organization, you know, over the next, you know, month, I think that he puts himself in a really good position to win that job heading into training camp. So the guy who has the most to gain, in my opinion, without a shadow of a doubt, is Drew Lock.
Second down. A fitting down for this question. We talked about second-year quarterbacks in the NFL a while ago, ones you think could make their mark, take a big step forward. But who are two second-year quarterbacks you're becoming increasingly worried about?
To me, it is Justin Fields with the Bears. I don't know what they've legitimately done to help him and surround him with talent. I feel like, okay, even with the coaching staff change and Matt Eberflus, who I think is a very bright, good defensive guy, and brought in Luke Getsy from the Green Bay Packers as the offensive coordinator, you can have a nice scheme, you can have a nice coaching staff, but if you don't have the talent or the players around a young quarterback to support him, it is going to fail.
It's almost like there's a problem at the top. That's crazy.
Just maybe with ownership. And I'm just worried for Justin Fields that this is a talented guy that I truly believe has the stuff to be able to make it in this league. but will never get the support that he needs. So I'm worried and concerned about Justin Fields. The other guy that I'm concerned about is Mac Jones. I mean, what's going on with the offensive coordinator situation or lack thereof with the New England Patriots is unbelievable to me. And the fact that Bill Belichick is trusting the offense with Matt Patricia and Joe Judge, I am blown away by. And Mac Jones needs to take the next step in his second season. He needs to show progression, not regression. And with what's going on offensively, I'm worried that Mac Jones is going to face that stumbling block in his second season in the pros. And what does that mean for this team and this organization moving forward? So my answer would be Justin Fields and Mac Jones. And I don't think there's really a close third there.
People talked about Trevor Lawrence before he was drafted, and everyone knew he'd be the number one overall pick. Like, he was the next Peyton Manning, like the most sure thing that a sure thing could ever be. Where does he fall on your scale of, I'm worried about this guy, where you have Mac Jones and Justin Fields, to, wow, this guy's going to make a huge jump forward. I'm so excited to watch it. Like, where does he fall?
I legitimately think he's going to make a big jump forward. I mean, he is being in a disastrous year with Urban Meyer as his head coach and a offense that was not dynamic whatsoever. I feel like with Doug Peterson, who is a quarterback-focused head coach, and the success that he has had everywhere that he has gone, I just really truly believe that it is an instant upgrade. And everybody can, you know, make fun of the Christian Kirk contract, and you should. You should make fun of it every day. But I do believe that they have bettered the team and the offense in terms of the overall talent they've surrounded with Trevor Lawrence. And so I do anticipate that he will take the next step and that he will show and flash the, you know, the talent and the promise of being the first overall pick and the clear-cut overall pick. So I am actually very optimistic about Trevor Lawrence. That doesn't necessarily mean I think the Jags are going to win a bunch of games, but I do believe that you're going to see a much more improved and much more effective Trevor Lawrence in year two.
Do you guys ever look at pictures of yourself from, you know, middle school or whatever, and see the frosted tips and the puka shells and the Supreme side parts, and just think, like, what was I doing? I can't believe that ever happened. I think that's what the NFL is going to feel about Urban Meyer. Third down. What players are you most interested in learning about over this OTA period?
Who I am most interested in learning about? I am interested in learning about the two tackles here for the Seahawks, and Charles Cross and Abraham Lucas, how they do going up against Daryl Taylor and Nwosu and Boye Mafe. I'm really looking forward to learning more about that. The other thing that I'm looking forward to learning more about is, as you talk about this transition into your defense, what it's going to require is it's going to require a lot of chemistry. It's going to require a lot of great communication from the coaching staff to the players. Jamal Adams, to my understanding, is not going to be there at OTAs in terms of participation because he's still recovering from injuries and doing that, I believe, away from campus, as far as I've been able to gather that information. So what I'm going to be interested in is how much can they grow together as a defensive back unit, knowing that you've got so much newness, you've got a lot of new faces at the cornerback position. How quickly can they gel? How quickly can they mesh? And what you don't want to see is a repeat of last offseason where there were no corners that made any separation whatsoever throughout the process. That no one stepped up. No one made any plays. And we were all sitting there trying to guess and trying to decipher, oh, was this because of, you know, practice rule changes or trying to give people benefit of the doubt? No. You need to see guys step up and stake their claim to these competitions, and particularly at the cornerback position. This should not be a mystery. It should be very obvious to the eye as to who's stepping up and who's really taking ownership of the opportunity to win a starting job. And that's what I'm going to be interested in.
Fourth down. We're going to talk about a benches clearing brawl coming up in the timeline next. And the fact, like, if a teammate gets into a fight, it's an unspoken rule in baseball that you get up and you go over. It's why you have bench clearing brawls. It's you can't be the only guy on the bench. It's an unspoken rule in baseball. What's an unspoken rule in football?
If there is no pads, if there's no pads on, you are going about 75% speed. If you go harder than the rules of engagement, I'll just say, you look like a total loser And also, you're going to make a lot of people mad, and you're going to start fights.
Is it like getting to class with optional seating, and you sit in the very front row, and people are like, what's this loser doing?
No, it's not that. It is more so that you're putting people at risk of injury, and you're also trying to make people look bad in regards to their job, right? We're all operating at the same level here, and we understand that, look, I don't have pads on, and
we have an unspoken agreement that you and I are doing in between a walkthrough and practice.
Correct. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're not trying to beat each other, but you're not going the extra mile. Like, for example, a defensive end, you're not going to lower your shoulder and try and bull rush. You're not going to, you know, try to, you know, do something in run period that could potentially knock down somebody and cause effect where they're going to, you know, fall into somebody's legs. Like, you're looking out for each other. And that is really the unspoken rule when you talk about the NFL. You see, you want to start a fight? Just try to go as hard as you can in a non-padded practice. That'll get people really upset real fast.
Have you ever seen a fight started from that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What happened?
100%. A fight happened.
No, I mean, like, what happened that caused the fight?
I would say that there are legendary stories about Earl Thomas in walkthroughs going 100% speed and actually hitting people with balls in the air, and it just did not end well. So it's also, you know, you've had guys like Jermaine Effetti who, you know, have tried to like finish blocks in non-padded practices, and Michael Bennett and Frank Clark getting mad and throwing punches and things like that. Like, there's just things that you just don't do.
Last related, you've been both a player and obviously experienced football as a fan. What's an unspoken football fan rule?
An unspoken football fan rule?
Curtis, if you can think of one too. An unspoken rule among football fans.
I mean, like, don't talk during the play.
That's a good one. And don't yell during offense, right? When your offense is on the field, you don't yell, you don't scream, you be quiet. But I mean, There's not really like
in baseball,
obviously, if someone's throwing a no-no or, you know, you have that, you don't jinx it. You don't say, hey, look what they're doing, or, you know, you don't want to try to jinx it and say what, you know, oh, man, I hope this does not happen, because more often than not, it's going to happen.
You know what I would like to make an unspoken rule?
What's that?
I would like to speak it into existence. Is you don't wear another jersey to that game.
You don't
show up to a Mariners game.
I can get down with that. You don't show up
to a UW football game in a Seahawks jersey.
Just wear regular clothes.
If you don't have a jersey, just don't wear that jersey. The uniform isn't jersey. The uniform is, do you have that team's gear or not? Not like a white or a black.
Well, then you got those people that show up to tonight, Mariners A's. They show up in their Chicago Cubs jersey. It's like, okay, that has no place being here either.
Yeah, it makes no sense. Like, you may be a Chicago Cubs fan.
Yeah.
Leave it at home.
So some quick suggestions.
Do not care.
Listeners. I've got a good one. When you're a fan of the away team at the home team stadium, you cheer quietly and respectfully to yourself. So you don't get up and like get in people's faces if you're part of the visiting team.
Well, that's just being smart, because if you do that, there's a lot of drunk people in the stands and you're going to start a fight. I have seen this happen when I was a recruit at the Apple Cup. Watched a Coug fan get his tooth knocked out because he was being ridiculous.
Jeez.
I mean, he had it coming to him, but being ridiculous in front of Husky fans.
It's Jake and Stacey. You're listening to Seattle Sports Station on 710 and the Seattle Sports app. I'll tell you what caused that bench-clearing brawl next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacey,
brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
It is The Timeline on Jake and Stacey, this hour brought to you by Advanced Hair Restoration. Before I get to that story, we were talking about unspoken rules, unspoken fan rules in football, in baseball. Let's see, Jake, you said, and Curtis, you said don't get up during a play. Baseball is a little
more
strict about that. Don't talk during a play. Don't get up to go to the bathroom. Don't be making ruckus. We had some people. I said that, you know, don't wear a jersey that doesn't fit. Like, if you're going to a UW game, a UW football game, even though it's football, don't wear a Seahawks jersey. In my mind, that's a pet peeve of mine. Or like a Mariners game. quick question. Someone said, what about going to still an NFL game? The Seahawks are not playing. Say it's Chargers Broncos, but you're wearing a Seahawks jersey. Is that acceptable?
Still just as bad.
Okay. Second question. Someone said, this is actually my suggestion for an unspoken rule from Will. When it's a pop-up into foul territory, if the opposing team is on defense, you do whatever you can to catch it. If the home team is on defense, it's presumably a pet peeve when fans aren't realizing that, like, no, you make way to let the player catch it, because people see the ball and they're like, oh, souvenir. And it's like, no, you need to back up.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a good one, because I do think that there are fans that don't realize that. They just think like, oh, hey, fair game.
Steve Bartman, prime example.
Yeah. Okay, so
yes.
To the timeline.
I mean, like, do we even know where he is anymore?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I feel bad for
that
guy.
I mean, I think he's still with us.
The 30 for 30 on that is one of the saddest things I have ever watched. Like, seriously, so incredibly sad.
They've won a World Series since then. Yes. Let the man live.
I know, but they don't.
What's
sad
is that fans of the team that he loves hate him.
Yes.
So it's
100%. Just like, what do you
do? I don't want to think about it right now. It makes me too bad. Okay. Yankees third baseman Josh Donaldson admitted to calling White Sox shortstop Tim Anderson Jackie, which sparked a bench-clearing brawl on Saturday. So first, what Tim Anderson had to say about the brawl and that exchange afterward.
Yeah, he just made a disrespectful comment. You know, basically, trying to call me Jackie Robinson. Like, what's up, Jackie? I don't play like that. I don't really play at all. I wasn't really bothering nobody today, but, he made a comment, and, it was disrespectful. I don't think it was called for. It was unnecessary.
Guys, when you guys crossed past the shortstop there at the end of the third?
Yeah, but that happened in the first time he got on, and I spared him that time. And it happened again. It's just uncalled for. I got time to, be playing like that.
How'd you manage to contain yourself based on that kind of comment?
I don't know, to be honest. it was very disrespectful, You don't want to play like that.
You called it disrespectful. Tony just said it was racist. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Same along that same line, yeah.
So he's saying that he felt that it was disrespectful, Josh Donaldson calling him Jackie. Josh Donaldson tries to explain his comment. He does admit to saying that, and then he tries to explain his comment.
First inning, I called him Jackie. Let me give you a little context of that. 2019, he came out with an interview and said that he's a new Jackie Robinson in baseball. He's going to bring back fun for the game. 2019, when I played for Atlanta, we actually joked about that on the game. And I've said it to him in years past, not in any manner than just joking around, but the fact that he called himself Jackie Robinson. If something has changed from that, my meaning of that is not any term trying to be racist by any fact of the matter. It was just off of an interview that what he called himself. We said that before, we joked about it, he laughed, whatever. As you could tell in our series that we played, there were multiple times where I tried to defuse the situation. Like, I took responsibility for the tag, wasn't trying to do anything there. Today, just trying to defuse it, like, hey, like, make light, like, we're not trying to start any brawls or anything like that. Obviously, he deemed that it was disrespectful, and if he did, I apologize. Like, that's not what I was trying to do by any manner.
I think the last part's the most important part to me, because the thing is, there's certainly a world in which Josh Donaldson, according to him and his early exchanges with Tim Anderson while he was with another team, was calling him Jackie, and Tim Anderson did not appreciate it, but was like, I'm not going to, whatever, I'll just laugh it off. I've been in this situation before. I'm not going to sit here and tell this guy why I don't like it. And then this guy just kept doing it and kept doing it and kept doing it, and then Tim Anderson just, had enough, or like didn't he? There's a world in which Tim Anderson has never seen it as a friendly exchange and has always
of course
it as taunting.
Of course, yeah, has always viewed it as taunting. I think that that context is important though when discussing the intent of whether it was racist or not, right? And I think that that part of it, a lot of the guys on the White Sox clubhouse, they don't buy it whatsoever. I mean, they've been very candid and very explicit with how much they don't buy it and how much they think it's a
buy him saying, oh, he
it's an inside joke. It's an inside joke that we've had this exchange many times before, and so it's a he said situation. And I really am curious as to Tim Anderson all of a sudden taking objection to being called this, right? Like, that's the part I don't know in this story, and we're just trying to figure out, obviously, if there was no history there, and this is a comment that he made.
Well,
I think that it's absolutely ridiculous, and honestly, you should never go there to begin with, even if it was something you talked about in 2019. I just don't see how Josh Donaldson sees it as something that is, you know, appropriate or funny or a mutual joke when it's not been taken that way, you know, at any point in their careers.
That's what Anderson's White Sox teammates are also saying. So pitcher Liam Hendricks, who obviously plays for the White Sox, says, usually you have inside jokes with people you get along with, not people you don't get along with at all. So that statement right there was complete things I can't say on air, but he's not buying it.
Yeah, 100%. And that's the thing is that it, from day one, whenever Josh Donaldson used it, it was a form of taunting, right? And that to me is where it crosses a line, and that it's not acceptable. It's not okay. And that, you know, eventually Tim Anderson takes exception to it and says something about it.
What ultimately matters is how Tim Anderson feels about it. So Josh Donaldson can say, I didn't mean it this way. I was just saying it like this. But if Tim Anderson, the subject of your joke, says, I don't appreciate it, I feel it's racist, I feel it offends me, that's it. End of discussion. Then you can, it's not very
you
difficult.
You can't be like, I didn't offend you.
Yeah, exactly. Who are you to say, oh, actually, it's not offensive, because this is how I meant it. If it offends that person, if the subject of your joke says, stop, I don't want to hear it, I don't like that, that crosses a line for me, that's the end of it. It doesn't mean you're this horrible person, but it does mean that the easiest thing for you to do in the world, that takes little to no effort, in fact, it takes even less effort, is to just not say it again.
Yeah, well, and just be like, hey, my bad. I mean, I that wasn't, even if he said it was, and he did say this, that it wasn't my intent, but it was more so like, oh, if Tim Anderson's going to be soft about this, then, you know, that's his, you know, problem, and I'm sorry about it. I just think that, you know, Josh Donaldson thinks he's being funny, or he thinks he's, you know, coming across a certain way and never was. So I just appreciate the fact that the White Sox, their clubhouse has Tim Anderson's back 100%, willing to get into a fight about it, willing to have their guys back, and to me that is a good clubhouse. That is a good clubhouse, and it's no surprise that they've been doing a lot of winning as of recent.
The 206 says, what a joke. So can someone not jab Josh and say he's the next Mantle? Everything's about race. Well, in a league that used to be segregated and black people were not allowed to participate, and in a country with a history of racism, yeah, something that is quite literally about a black player who broke the color barrier is about race, because it depends how you're using that context. Are you calling him Jackie in a way that makes him feel singled out and uncomfortable or mocked? If that's the case, then yeah, I just feel like you can't remove context from those conversations when the joke is mentioning someone who's quite literally part of desegregating MLB.
Right. If he had said, if in context, you have to add the context to that of Jackie Robinson and his history, right? But someone saying that, if he called him okay Griffey, like that wouldn't have the same context whatsoever. It would not have the same racist undertone to it as it does with somebody like Jackie Robinson. I think it's very clear cut. I mean, acting ignorant how that could come across as a racist, comment. I don't think it takes all that much to come to that conclusion. So I think that also someone saying, did Tim Anderson tell Josh Donaldson that he didn't like it? Maybe he just went on and didn't feel like he should approach it with Tim Anderson with Josh Donaldson for a while. And it's not like he smiled about it or laughed or joked with him, that he just didn't say anything. And at one point, you know, he's heard enough. Like, I think that could very easily be the case as well.
All right, I want to get back to the Mariners, see how you guys are feeling. I've got some listener reaction. I've got reaction to it, something I didn't have time to say earlier that I just know is going to get me in trouble, but I'm going to say it anyways. Also, Ryan Divish going to join us in about 20 minutes. So going to get deep into the Mariners here for the next 30 or so. Don't go anywhere.
Jake and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On Seattle's Sports Station.
Here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Rost.
We are taking you around the diamond thanks to Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. The Mariners return home from a 9-game road trip today. They'll open with a series against the A's. First pitch is at 6:40 p.m. Pregame show starts at 5:30 p.m. right here on Seattle Sports Station. And that's Around the Diamond, brought to you by Shane Company. I asked you guys earlier in the show how you're feeling about the Mariners right now. I know that reactions to baseball games, especially a single series, are not supposed to be emotional. They're not supposed to be overreactions. And yet, I got so many reactions from people, many of which are emotionally charged and many of which I think a lot of you will identify with. Some of you might hate them because you're going to disagree with each other, but I appreciated everyone texting in. I'm going to read a couple of them, and then I want to mention how I was feeling this morning and how we were talking about it. So from listeners, I feel like Clark Griswold on Christmas Vacation when he was banking on getting a big Christmas bonus and instead got enrolled in the Jelly of the Month Club for his bonus. That's how this person is feeling about the current Mariners season. Someone else says,
the gift that keeps on giving.
I know. Someone else said, I'm disappointed but far from panicked. I expected Atlanta fans felt similarly this time last year. The M's are a young team with plenty of growth potential. Patience.
Don't.
Well, look, I don't. This person is not the only person feeling this way. Someone else said, I'm pretty dang frustrated myself. It's been 20 years of the same nonsense. One better than expected year to give us hope of ending the drought, then an unwillingness to fully commit in the offseason, filling roster holes because they don't want to admit they need to overpay for most big free agents. I'm convinced free agents are actively told by their agents to avoid Seattle unless they're significantly overpaid compared to other offers. This is what this listener says. He's just pretty disappointed by the lack of moves this offseason. That one shared by a couple people. Someone else saying, look, it's a brutal schedule, bad weather, slow starters. The M's are going to turn it around in a big way. So as you can see, lots of mixed responses from people.
Yeah, definitely. And you know what? It is... You can get yourself caught up in the, hey, it's a long season and there's opportunities to turn things around. But we all have to admit that it would have to be a pretty big turnaround for them to be able to come out of this deficit that they're currently in and to be able to compete with the Astros and the Angels. That's what we're talking about. It's not just overcoming, you know, being 10 games back. It's also being able to keep pace with the Astros and the Angels right now, who look by far at the better team right now. And when we talk about, you know, just speaking honestly here, right? We speak honestly to what is currently going on. It doesn't mean you don't have to. There's two ways to look at it. Be honest in the moment and be also honest in terms of the rebuild or what can happen in the long term. And I think that, you know, when you're talking about this team, there are plenty of things to look at the current moment and say, you know what? I am skeptical.
So the way that I was feeling about it this morning, I'm going to preface this by saying which is that I recognize that, no, let me say this. I am telling myself I'm not on air right now, so I can be very frank. One of my biggest pet peeves about sports as a medium, sports talk as a medium, but just like the venue and area of sports and the conversations we have around it, is that people have a lot of ownership over things, which is fantastic. You should have ownership and a personal investment in your team. I relate to that. But one of my biggest pet peeves as someone who has felt like an outsider to sports, because I got into it a bit later when I was older, is this idea that there is only one way to be a fan. So I care about the Mariners' success. I hope that the Mariners get to a World Series. I very much enjoy covering many people on this team. Okay. Being said,
Let it out, Stacey.
Don't care about 1995.
Them's fighting words.
Come on,
around these parts.
Now,
come
I
on,
understand.
Stacey.
No, listen. I understand the historical significance. I really do. I understand that 1995 was important, not just because of the season, not just because of the double, not just because of the players, but because it saved baseball in Seattle. Like, I understand the history around it. However, I almost look at it as like an outsider's point of view, right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't grow up a baseball fan. I was 5 years old. It just does not carry quite the same weight for me. In fact, I'm even looking at it now, I feel like I can't say anything because people get all upset and they say something like, you shouldn't be on sports radio in Seattle if you don't love 1995. And I always want to say, well, time out. Wait a minute. How old are you? How old were you in 1995? Well, that probably plays into it. Secondly, I wasn't a sports fan at the time because I wasn't encouraged to like sports. And thirdly, I just want us to all take a second and think about something. We celebrate a season, We celebrate a season in which this team did not get to a World Series. I know that that's I know that that's rude to say. I understand that some of you are going to be really mad about it, but it's the truth. We celebrate a season with videos, excitement, bobbleheads, celebrity guest appearances. It is a huge part of culture in Seattle, and they didn't get to a World Series.
You could also throw 2001 onto that as well.
They also didn't get to a
World Series. That's all I'm saying. I'm saying that that idea of just constantly looking at one year saying, wow, wasn't this special, is not enough for me because it doesn't mean anything to me. And so that's all it is. That's how I feel about it. I understand that some of you are going to think that's ridiculous and I'm not being appreciative, but I need you to consider my age at the time. And I also need you to consider that there are people who look at it and just don't feel the same way you do, and quite frankly are probably more impatient as a result. Like, I am more impatient with this rebuild because I look at it and say 1995 isn't enough for me. It's not enough for a lot of people, and I'm tired of looking at it as though it's like the best thing to ever happen to this city when you have the resources to make something else really cool happen in this city. You've got one of the best players in baseball. You've got this really fun young team. You had a ton of money to spend in the offseason. You can do something fun. You can make this a baseball city, and I am just disappointed by the start of the season. I understand there's a lot of season left to play, but I want something special. I want a year that means enough to me and that means something to me in the way that 95 means to other people, but I don't feel that connection, and so I'm sorry. That's how I feel about it. I think it's I want something more.
Well, I don't I hear you. It's also, you know, 95 means a lot to this city in terms of baseball and what it meant. But also when it comes down to the fact that you're still having to pull back to those memories in 2001, should tell you an awful lot about the current stage of this organization. And I 100% get what you're saying on that. And I I think that this organization has to be able to get to the next level and to be able to create those new memories that you're talking about, and that, you know, the urgency should be at an all-time high in regards to, you know, being able to get to that next stage of Mariners baseball and to be able to create that winning culture, because right now there is not a winning culture. There is not a winning culture in regards to what the expectation should be. And that's why I think a lot of people can sit here and look through the past 20 years and say, you know what, have patience. It's really hard to do that.
Okay.
And I'm with you.
We are going to, while people are busy yelling at me on the text line, I don't care what you think. We're going to bring on Ryan Divish next. Don't go anywhere.